Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a gathering of self-proclaimed geeks at the Arizona Fall League.
And the state gives school letter grades each year. What do they mean and how do they impact so-called failing schools?
But first, it is raining this morning, so you might not be planning to spend the day relaxing outside by the pool. But the next time you do, there is a chance your lounging might be caught on camera without your knowledge. According to a new report in AZ Mirror, insurance companies are starting to use AI-powered balloons to take aerial photographs around the state, raising a fresh round of questions about the line between corporate data gathering and consumer privacy. Jared McDonald Evoy wrote that piece for AZ Mirror, and he joins me now. Jared, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. To start, you have an example of one of these images in your piece. Can you just describe for us what it shows?
These images are taken from an area that would be kind of described as near space, and they kind of just are able to show kind of very high resolution images of someone's property from at a very high altitude at a very high resolution.
Okay. And what exactly is going on here? How are these photographs being taken?
Yeah, so the company that is doing this, Near Space Labs, sends up what are called stratospheric balloons to lift these AI robotic pieces of equipment that they have that have these very high-powered cameras up higher than where you would see a commercial airliner, but a little bit lower than where satellites would be out in near space, hence the name Near Space Labs for this company. And then once those balloons reach a certain altitude, they detach and they kind of glide down on parachutes and take a series of photos of a wide area. And these images are such high resolution that they're able to kind of crop in and zoom in and kind of get photos of a very wide area, but still be able to get photos down on a very small granular level of a single house.
And the idea, in part, for Near Space is that this is technology that insurance companies would use. What would they use these images for?
Yeah, we've already seen some examples of companies using this technology. There is one insurance company called Swiss Re that is using this particular company, and they're using it for property risk assessment. Essentially, what they're doing is they'll have this company gather these photos of an area where they want to know what the rates should be, or if they should be even offering coverage in an area that might be deemed too high risk for wildfire. We saw this happen in California, where some homeowners were being told that their insurance, their homeowners insurance wasn't going to be offered anymore through their company. So some companies are now using this type of technology to determine if they're going to offer insurance in areas, or to say, well, the roof of your house is, it's not up to code. You need to fix the roof of your house here, or we're not going to insure you anymore.
Now, in your piece, Jared, you confirmed that these balloons and this tech is already being used in dozens of cities around the state, including right here in the Valley. But you also point out that insurance companies taking these kinds of photographs, that's not exactly a new thing. It's the scale that this technology enables that's new, right?
Correct. Insurance companies have been using aerial photography for decades to create assessments of properties or create these type of risk assessments as well. Often using small fixed wing aircraft that they'll hire out to go take photos. You'll see these type of aircraft quite often flying in Arizona. The difference is that this is at a much higher level, at a much greater scale, and it's also using artificial intelligence. So you have a kind of culmination of a bunch of different technologies that are happening at once that haven't really ever been used before in this particular space. And that causes some people who like the American Civil Liberties Union to have some pause about what this might mean for privacy concerns. You know, who are these companies other than insurance companies selling this data to and these photos to?
Right. And you actually spoke to the ACLU's Speech Privacy and Technology Project about this. And they told you this is a pretty complicated question, right?
Correct. It is, because if it were the government doing something like this, it would raise a pretty heavy constitutional issue. It would be a First Amendment issue pretty much right away. There would also be a Fourth Amendment issue right away, where certain, you know, things would get triggered pretty quickly, where if this was the government doing this. But when it comes to a private company, there are a lot less guardrails to protect the citizenry from what's going on here. And there's also a lot less transparency on this. We can't really see the internals. We can't make a FOIA request or public records request for what a private company is doing. And the kind of interactions between private company and private company, or private individual and private individual, aren't exactly as open as, say, if a government was doing this sort of wide area photography. So it makes it a little bit more opaque on what we can know and what we can learn about how this is being done. Now, Nearspace Labs allows for users to request imagery that is taken. I requested some imagery. I have yet to get any imagery, and it's unclear what kind of imagery they would release. And even if that is fully the capabilities, you know, that they would show you their full capabilities just from this request imagery section that they have.
Just about 30 seconds left here, Jared. The company that makes this technology, which again is Nearspace Labs, they're also active in places like Texas and California. And in California, there's been an attempt to regulate what they are allowed to do. What is the status of those efforts?
Yeah, the regulation ended up getting held in committee. It didn't end up moving through anywhere, but that regulation would have allowed consumers to have a right to see the photos that were used to dispute, change, or cut their insurance. That bill got held in committee, didn't go anywhere. But that bill was basically a direct response to this and other types of technology, particularly drones that have been being used to fly over people's property, take photos of it, and use those photos to kind of cancel people's insurance without really giving them an opportunity to have a say.
All right. Well, that is Jared McDonald Evoy. He's a reporter and wrote about this for AZ Mirror. Jared, thank you as always.
Thank you as always for having me on.
Arizona's newest round of school letter grades are out. And the good news is most Arizona schools are getting an A or a B, 78%. About 18% are getting a C grade, 44 schools got a D, and 13 schools received an F grade. That's up from 5 failing schools the year prior. Now, assigning one letter grade to an entire school is tricky business. But do they lead to bigger divides between quote-unquote good schools and bad schools? And who gets stuck in those? Well, our next guest says they can be used by parents as a starting point and for failing schools as guideposts for improvement. Rebecca Beebe is Director of Governmental Affairs for the Arizona School Administrators Association. And in today's deep dive, she told me these grades are actually required by law.
So this is actually a federal requirement. The federal government requires that every state adopt an accountability system. And the purpose of those accountability systems are to show the public how a school is performing. And so this is a state law that's based on a federal law.
Okay.
Some other states instead do like a report card system where you can see multiple factors about a school and each factor is given, you know, a number of stars or a letter grade.
Mm-hmm.
But in Arizona, our state law that we've had for many years does require that every single public school get one single summative letter grade.
Okay. So one letter grade to represent an entire school. There are obviously, you know, people who will take issue with that. But let's back up first and just talk about what factors go into that letter grade. Like, how do you come to that conclusion?
Yeah. So it's difficult, right? Because schools are diverse across the state. We have rural schools. We have small schools. We have really, really large schools. The letter grades come from the Department of Education, and they're based on a formula. And some of the components of that formula are things like test scores, college and career readiness indicators at the high school level, mm-hmm. and other acceleration indicators at the elementary level. But a big chunk of the formula for both elementary school grades and high school letter grades is test scores, standardized test scores.
Right.
So parents and listeners, you may remember just this past spring, if you have a child in a public school, they took the AASA if they're in elementary school, or they took the ACT if they're in high school.
Yep.
You know, a couple years ago, it was called AZ Merit. When I was in school, it was called the Ames test.
I remember Ames. This is all the same thing. Okay.
Yeah. So I think this is really important context, that the federal government requires every state to give the same test to every student in the state.
Yeah.
And so every state doesn't give the same test, but if you live in a state, every student in that state is taking the same test so that we can compare. Hmm. And those test scores make up a lot of the letter grade, both the proficiency, so if kids are scoring proficient, but yeah. we also include growth in our letter grade system. We want to recognize as a state when a kid comes to a school lower in their proficiency or maybe not proficient, mm-hmm. maybe they don't make it too proficient that year, but they grow quite a bit.
So growth matters.
Growth matters a lot. I mean, your kid is showing up in third grade in April on that one day being tested on everything they learned that year.
Right.
Some kids do really well on tests. Some don't. Some kids show up that day hungry. Some kids show up that day tired. Mm-hmm. And we know the research shows that proficiency scores are often tied to – they're not imperfect, but they're not perfect either. They're often tied to the socioeconomic status of the family.
Yeah. Okay. So growth, lots of other factors go into this, but it's still one grade in the end. I wonder how you think we should use that one grade, right? Like as a parent, if you're looking at a school and saying, should I send my kid to this school or should I send my kid to a school with a much better letter grade?
So I think letter grades for parents are a good starting point, because these letter grades are based on several factors. And so maybe you take that letter grade, you see that your school has a C letter grade.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, I would say a C is performing, your average performance. So a C isn't failing, right? But maybe you see that C and you wonder, okay, is this the right school for my kid?
Yeah.
I would suggest you dive a little deeper into what makes up that C. As I mentioned, there's parts of the formula that are based on test scores, but there's other parts of the formula based on acceleration indicators, like how many eighth graders are taking algebra instead of waiting till high school? What's the chronic absentee rate? So you can take that letter grade as a starting point, go to the Arizona Department of Education website, and look up the report card for your child's school or for the school you're looking at.
Mm.
That report card is going to have test scores broken down by subgroup. How are English language learners doing? How are students with disabilities doing? How are African American students doing? Hispanic Latino students, Indigenous students? You know, you can go to that report card website and see the experience level of the teachers. Are they certified? Are they not certified? What's the percentage of certified teachers? But certainly there's just so much more context to a school district than their letter grades, and so much you may be missing out on knowing about a specific school without doing a little further deep dive into what that school has to offer. What's the
yeah.
culture of the school?
Yeah.
How long have the teachers been there? What do your neighbors think? You know, where do your neighbors go to school? And what do they think of the school? There's just so much that we're missing out by just yeah. looking at the letter grade.
The letter grade only tells you so much. So, I mean, does this, paired with the fact that we have open enrollment and you can send your kid to any district and whatever school is performing really well in these grades, does this kind of system, required as it is, lead to, contribute to segregation, you think?
I think the way – that's a deep question.
Yeah.
I think the way that I would answer that is to come back to this idea of, if you are a parent, do you believe that your child's worth is based on, you know, their score on a high stakes test at the end of the year? There's so much more to a school than those test scores. And I think we try really hard to create an accountability system that doesn't just reflect the socioeconomic status of the school. Proficiency, especially, is just so often tied to economic status.
Right. So if you're looking at letter grades based mostly on test scores, do you end up with, you know, low scoring schools in low economic areas?
Well, when I look at the list of the F schools, yeah, they have a couple commonalities. They're mm-hmm. low socioeconomic status and or rural.
Mm-hmm.
So as much as we try, and I think we do try very hard to include other things in our formula, like these acceleration indicators and college and career readiness indicators. You know, how many of your kids are going on to post-secondary? You can get bonus points for post-secondary enrollment and military enrollment. You
yeah.
can get bonus points if you have a high special ed rate. You can get bonus points and points for kids earning industry earning credentials in CTE programs. So we try really hard to make up for to have a system that's not just based on test scores. But
yeah.
I do think it's important for people to understand, you know, social determinants can influence someone's ability to be ready for school.
Yeah. Okay, we'll talk more about the impact of these school letter grades in just a moment. That is Arizona School Administrators Association Director of Governmental Affairs, Rebecca Beebe. More of our conversation after the break. Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, we'll meet a group of baseball fans with a unique interest in the game.
I actually have a title. I'm world-renowned. I am absolutely the worst fantasy baseball player ever in the history of the world.
We will visit the 30th edition of a Valley Fantasy Baseball Symposium.
And now let's return to my deep dive conversation with Rebecca Beebe, Director of Governmental Affairs with the Arizona School Administrators Association. And Rebecca, let me ask you about the impact on a school of getting this kind of letter grade, right? Like if you're a teacher or an administrator or a coach or something at a school working every day to try to educate these kids and, you know, you get an F, what's that like? What does that do to the school culture?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm glad you asked that because it really can bring morale down in a school. You know, we talk about schools in a broad way, but we forget that there's hundreds of little souls in that school, right? Attending school. And in these F schools, these are schools that parents choose. Sometimes they're the only option in a rural area, but mm-hmm. parents are typically happily involved in these schools. They're staffed with high quality teachers and administrators. I did reach out to a couple, schools on the D and F list, and I asked, you know, in some cases, these folks and these schools were just a point or two away mm-hmm. from a higher letter grade. But certainly it can be very demoralizing.
Is there a system in place to help schools get out of that area if they're performing poorly, if they get an F? Like, are there programs that are going to help them not get an F next year?
Yeah, there is some help from the Department of Ed, from the school turnaround team. Arizona has literacy coaches in our classroom. So we have statewide some stagnant reading scores and literacy scores, which is typical across the country. You know, after COVID, every state struggled with test scores. So it's nothing bad or unique about mm-hmm. Arizona. What we know works, especially with literacy with young kids, is we have a coaching program. We have literacy coaches in Arizona. We have 36 currently that work in our lowest performing schools. We base this off of a program carried out in Mississippi called the Mississippi Miracle. And one of the biggest parts of the Mississippi Miracle, they raised their literacy proficiency scores hugely over the course of 11 years,
yeah.
is that the state invested in literacy coaches. And these are teachers who work specifically with kids on literacy intervention all day. That's all they do. And I think, you know, letter grades are meant to be a tool for schools on how to improve, too. So when we see these lower test scores or lower literacy scores, schools know what types of interventions could help raise those. It comes down to a question of staffing availability, funding availability. But certainly we're trying to raise awareness about this literacy program. The state has a goal of getting 50 literacy coaches in the classroom by 2026.
Mm-hmm.
And I think from this data that's come out with the letter grades and the test scores, that would be a great investment for the state.
Let me ask you lastly, Rebecca, about, I guess, the other part of the conversation about schools in Arizona in general, which is always about funding, right? How are these letter grades, you think, related to funding? Like, do you think, you know, if we weren't the 49th state in the country when it comes to school funding, we would have better rated schools?
Yeah, I would say so. We're pretty low in terms of funding, but we're middle of the pack in terms of achievement. So mm-hmm. I would say Arizona schools are already doing pretty incredible work with less resources. And I think we can be an example to some of these East Coast states who maybe had more homogeneous populations than we do of how we embrace diversity in our schools. We accept every kid, regardless of the language they speak, regardless of the income in their home, regardless of their ability. We accept every student. And with those limited resources, we still considerably do pretty well. I think I would go back to the example of the literacy coaches. If we could get more highly qualified individuals in schools working directly with students, especially in those young grades, on things like literacy, I've been hearing a lot of conversation in the public and from public policymakers about low literacy scores. You know, my answer to low test scores or low letter grades would be let's invest in the resources that we know help student achievement. You know, it would be helpful for the state to continue investing in things like a literacy coach, in things like math interventionists in schools. That also helps. Not only does it help the student, it gives the teacher a break when their lowest performing students can be pulled out of the classroom or worked with one-on-one in the classroom on their literacy skills, on their reading. It helps the student obviously achieve. It helps the classroom environment. Because sometimes our lower achievers are class clowns maybe or something like that. And it helps with teacher retention because they have another professional in there helping them. I think teachers are doing their best every single day in really hard circumstances. The teacher shortage, I think, certainly doesn't help. We have to remember this in the context of, the teacher shortage.
An ongoing teacher shortage for decades now, yeah. And new stats out on that just this week saying, 1,000 teachers have quit since July. So that obviously the teacher shortage issue has been tied to funding for years, but salaries have been bolstered. I mean, I wonder, I guess, when it comes to letter grades in schools, like, are those going to impact the teacher shortage, you think, in a negative way, in a positive way? What's the connection in your mind?
I think that would be a better question for a teacher, but I do think that it is really devastating to be labeled failing, to be labeled low performing. And without all the other context involved, to have a student come to second grade not speaking English, maybe at the end of third grade they're not going to be proficient. But I think everybody that knows that student would probably be absolutely amazed by the English skills and the literacy skills and all the other skills they pick up in school in just a year and a half. So these letter grades really require some context and some deep digging to really understand more than just the one single summative letter grade.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there. Rebecca Beebe is the Director of Governmental Affairs for the Arizona School Administrators Association. Rebecca, thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Arizona is one of four states included in a program to allow for the coverage of traditional Native American healing practices for Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program recipients. It comes as part of a waiver allowing states to pilot new programs. Netta Hassanin covers health care for Stateline and has written about this. She spoke with our co-host Mark Brody, and they started with how significant tribal officials are saying this approval is for their members.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hearing it's really quite significant. The U.S. government has a long history of policies that have targeted and outlawed tribal languages, cultural and religious practices, and that included traditional healing. So tribes had still practiced, but, out of sight. And the Indian Religious Freedom Act wasn't enacted until 1978. So tribal health leaders are really excited about this and hope that, incorporating, cultural remedies and practices will actually, improve health disparities that American Indian and Alaska Native folks often grapple with. Research is catching up and showing that, incorporating, cultural ways can help, improve, for example, substance use recovery treatments, et cetera.
Well, so how exactly does this work? Like, if you are a member of a Native American tribe and you are a Medicaid or CHIP recipient, how do you go about trying to make sure that you can get the kind of traditional healing that you're looking for?
Yeah, so it's only available at tribal health facilities. So, an American Indian, Alaska Native person in Arizona, could call their tribal health facility that they receive care at and, ask what traditional healing services are offered. And, that might differ, from facility to facility. It differs from, tribe to tribe. The self-determination and sovereignty was really baked into this, so that tribes and tribal health facilities can kind of choose, which traditional healing services to offer. But yeah, I mean, it's also available at urban Indian organizations as long as they contract with a tribal health facility. That's the case in Arizona, so it's available in that way.
I assume, though, and you kind of alluded to this, that the facilities would need providers, right, who are familiar with and know what they're doing with these traditional healing services, right? Like, you can't just offer it if you don't have somebody who can actually provide it.
Yeah, that's correct. And it's really important for tribes. I'm hearing that they, are really kind of trying to protect, the sacredness of their ceremonies and practices. And the authenticity of them. And so, there are a couple of organizations, for example, a couple of Navajo organizations that kind of certify, licensure of traditional healers. And so that's how they kind of make sure it's trusted people that, come from the community.
Understanding that the services will be different, as you reference, depending on where somebody is and maybe what tribal affiliation they have, what are some of the traditional healing services that folks are looking to offer?
Yeah, I mean, it could range from, plant medicine to, sweat ceremonies, sweat lodge ceremonies that incorporate, specific rituals, talking circles. Those are just a few examples.
And in terms of actually getting reimbursed, like, has Medicaid come up with a coding for some of these? Like, is it an easy, I guess, logistical administrative thing for a facility to get reimbursed for providing this?
Mm-hmm. So, it's actually something that states, are working on, that tribes are working on with states. And I should note, this has only been approved in Arizona, California, New Mexico, and Oregon. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very, new still. And so, I'm hearing from, tribal health facilities and tribal leaders that, they're still kind of trying to, figure out exactly, what the billing codes would be and that kind of thing.
What are you hearing from tribal health officials and tribal officials generally about how often they expect these services to be used, or maybe how much demand there is for these kinds of services?
Yeah. So I'm hearing that it would kind of vary from patient to patient, right? These are kind of holistic practices that providers and, traditional health practitioners would, within these tribal health facilities would kind of work with the patient to see if that's something they want or not. So it's kind of an offering that I think, what I'm hearing from practitioners and providers is that they would work with patients to see if that's, work with individual patients to incorporate it as part of their treatment plan, if that's what they want.
Sure. Is there concern in this space for the potential impact of a prolonged government shutdown, or if the Medicaid cuts that are planned for next year go into effect? I mean, this is only eligible, Medicaid and CHIP patients are eligible for this. If there are fewer people eligible and on Medicaid, presumably that limits the universe of potential patients who could get these services covered, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely a larger context, of concern here with if certain people lose eligibility, then they might not get to, have the coverage in order to get to the facility for care and to get this care. The Medicaid cuts, what I'm hearing from, tribal health facilities is that's kind of the concern, is if eligibility gets, even on accident, someone gets, kicked off the rolls, that's how it would affect someone's access to this kind of care.
But based on your reporting, it doesn't sound like there's an awful lot of concern about this particular service being taken away from Medicaid enrollees.
Yeah, that's correct.
All right. That is Netta Hassanin, a healthcare reporter at Stateline. Netta, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Arizona is famous for hosting Major League Baseball spring training every year. But baseball is a year-round event in Arizona. After the regular season ends, teams send a select group of up-and-coming minor leaguers to the Arizona Fall League, which just wrapped its 2025 season this past weekend. The Fall League is a chance for baseball players to prove themselves, but it's also a unique opportunity for a certain kind of baseball fan.
I am smart enough to know that I don't know everything, so there's always something that you can learn.
That is the voice of Wayne Edwards. He is standing in the conference room of a Sheraton in Mesa wearing a Savannah Bananas baseball jersey. He is one of about 200 people who have come from all over the country for the 30th annual installment of the First Pitch Arizona Fantasy Baseball Symposium. It's a four-day gathering of baseball geeks, their term, not mine, put on by a company called Baseball HQ. Wayne has been playing fantasy baseball since 2004.
I actually have a title. I'm world-renowned. I am absolutely the worst fantasy baseball player ever in the history of the world.
When I ask Wayne to back up this claim, he tells me that in over 20 years of playing fantasy baseball, he has won his league once, finished second another time, and one season he came in third.
And the rest of the time, doesn't matter.
So I have to ask, what keeps you coming back every year?
I love it. It's mind candy.
Baseball HQ was founded by a guy named Ron Chandler. When Ron walks into the conference room, Wayne breaks into a big smile and introduces me.
This is the godfather, by the way. That's Ron Chandler.
Hello, hey, nice to meet you.
Hi, yeah, I started this conference 30 years ago, so...
You did. Like everybody else at the hotel, Ron is a pretty hardcore fantasy baseball player. But unlike everybody else, Ron is also the author of a series of books called Ron Chandler's Baseball Forecaster. He puts out a new edition every year. A lot of people at the Sheraton are carrying copies of last year's Forecaster under their arms. Ron is kind of a big deal. Maybe you've seen the movie or read the book Moneyball, where a baseball team called the Oakland Athletics starts winning tons of games, despite the fact that, on paper, they have a bunch of mediocre players. It's based on the true story of some baseball geeks, led by a guy named Billy Bean, who worked in the Athletics front office in the early 2000s. They made up for their lack of raw talent and giant payroll by exploiting parts of the game that other teams didn't think about. While everybody else was focused on hitting home runs and racking up strikeouts, Bean honed in on more obscure statistics, like on-base percentage. If the Athletics could figure out a way to clog up the base paths, creating headaches and stress for opposing pitchers, they were likely to score a bunch of runs. So that's exactly what they did, and it worked. Before long, every other team in the major leagues was trying to figure out how Billy Bean was doing it. But Ron Chandler knew exactly how he was doing it.
When Moneyball came out, I mean, honestly, I took a look at the things that Billy Bean was doing, and I was thinking to myself, I've been doing this for 3 or 4 years already.
Ron was already a legend in the fantasy baseball world by that point. He says a lot of major league teams are only just now catching up to the ideas he's been writing about for years. Ron started Baseball HQ as a way to share his insights with fellow fantasy players looking for an edge in their leagues. He knew there were a lot of other people out there like him. But 30 years ago, it wasn't as easy to find them.
Fantasy has always been those things, you know, people hide in their basement and you don't really talk about. I mean, it's kind of a solitary pursuit.
So Ron helped dream up the idea for the First Pitch Symposium. He decided to time it so it would coincide with the Arizona Fall League, which he figured would be catnip for stat junkies like him. The Fall League is where major league teams send promising minor leaguers they hope will blossom into all-stars. Ron envisioned hordes of fantasy players spending a weekend together, salivating over Fall League standouts that would eventually be eligible for their rosters, and swapping strategies to win their leagues. He recruited some of the smartest people he knew to give talks, And in 1994, the inaugural First Pitch Arizona Symposium finally happened.
We had 8 attendees and 13 speakers.
But as the years went by, First Pitch got bigger and bigger. These days, it attracts not just hundreds of fantasy team owners, but prominent baseball writers and podcasters. And it's developed a reputation as a way to unlock your true baseball geek potential. At the Sheraton, I meet a guy named Dwayne, who's on a pretty impressive run.
I've won a championship and I have a consistent streak of like top 3 finishes for almost a decade, and so I feel like I'm doing really well.
The fantasy players at First Pitch are hell-bent on finding their version of on-base percentage, what Moneyball referred to as market inefficiencies. I talked to a guy named Ryan who thinks it might be playing time. He spends hours analyzing how many innings teams let their players spend on the field, trying to see if that could be a way to predict something. To be honest, I wasn't really sure what. I'm not sure Ryan is either. He just thinks playing time might mean something. In the hotel lobby, I meet two women from Chicago, Jen Frankenthal and her friend Kara Breitzman. Kara is working on her own theory of the next market inefficiency.
I'm a clinical psychologist, and I'm really interested in people and personalities, and I think the way that I can make it through trying to get to know an entire player pool is because each individual is so interesting. You know, getting to know the players and sort of where their passions lay, how they feel about, you know, like the team that they're playing for, the game of baseball in general, or the community that exists within baseball players. I think those things, when those things are strong in an individual, I think that also shows up in how successfully they play.
How do you measure that? Kara's friend Jen explains.
You watch how he walks up onto the plate, that, you know, whether it's looking confident, feeling good, and then when he makes a mistake, is he like, I'm mad, or is he like, no problem, I'll get him next time. Like how you read people in real life.
Speaking of real life, if all of this sounds like an absurd amount of time to spend obsessing about baseball, well, the baseball geeks know that. That is what they love about First Pitch.
Most of my friends' eyes glaze over when I start talking about fantasy baseball. Here, everyone's like, yeah, and everybody's into it.
A guy named Scott, who's come all the way from Salem, Oregon, tells me that his favorite part of First Pitch is the stuff that happens outside the conference rooms.
Sometimes it's the hallway chats, the hallway conversations of the late poker nights. And
what happens at the poker nights? Just more talking baseball?
I don't actually do the poker, but you can just hang out outside and people are just, you know, everyone's friendly. Everyone's easy to talk to. That's the craziest thing, is pretty much everyone here is easygoing and accessible.
Scott is standing with his friend Lucas. They've been in touch online for a while, but this is their first time meeting in person. I can tell they're really hitting it off. Is it possible to get tired of talking about baseball?
Not for me. I've been a baseball fan for 55 years, probably. I never get tired of it.
For me, I don't get tired of it, although it does feel a little like surreal or not used to it. So you're like, oh, wow, we've been talking baseball for like 4 days in a row.
That feeling that First Pitch is a little surreal in a good way, that's something I hear a lot at the Sheraton. Wayne, the guy in the Savannah Bananas jersey, says he's not the same person here as he is when he's back home in Georgia.
I'm at a party in my two-story brick front traditional Atlanta, the suburbs. I mean, come on. Look, I'm a CPA and a fantasy baseball nut. Mention that in a cocktail party. Just put me in the room and hang a hat on me, because nobody's going to want to talk to me. But you get here, we all love this. We all speak the same language.
Later in the evening, there's a special meeting in another conference room. It's for people who are at the symposium for the first time. One of the organizers, Brent Hershey, stands at the front of the room and welcomes the rookies. He asks everybody to look down at their name tags, where they'll find a little red sticker with a number 1 on it.
It is basically so that Anyone that has been here before knows very quickly that you're a first-timer. And we go out of our way, and this has been from Ron Chandler, started it 30 years ago, that it's always been an inclusive place like this, where you can come here totally by yourself and, like, meet new friends.
Brent says that means the new folks should not be shy about asking for a ride to a fall league game or an invite to the poker table, even if you're used to being a hat rack.
If you're able to step out and do that, you'll find lots of like-minded people.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Finally today, a postscript to a story that we aired about 2 weeks ago. On Monday, November 3rd, I told you about my conversation with folk singer Todd Snyder, who had been scheduled to play a show that evening at the Van Buren. As you may recall, that story ended with the unexpected postponement of Todd's show. At the time, it seemed like the postponement might have something to do with something Todd told me about during our conversation, a steadily worsening case of degenerative arthritis that he had been battling for the last several years. Shortly after we got off the air, however, Todd's team posted a troubling message to his Instagram page, stating that Todd had been the victim of a violent assault of some kind before a performance in Salt Lake City, and that the entire tour was being postponed so he could recover. Over the next few days, some murky details began to emerge about the alleged assault, but it was never really clear what had happened. This past Friday, another ominous message appeared on his social media feeds. After being admitted to the hospital to treat his injuries, doctors had diagnosed Todd with pneumonia, and he wasn't doing well. On Saturday morning, the feeds were updated one last time. Todd Snyder had passed away at the age of 59. As you know, if you listened to the story I did about him, I was a huge fan of Todd Snyder, and since his death, I have been reflecting on what I think we are losing without his voice. I'm hardly qualified to comment on his place in music history. Suffice it to say that his obituaries have name-checked many of his heroes in their assessment of his career: Jimmy Buffett, Jerry Jeff Walker, Kris Kristofferson, and John Prine. But just as important as his music, I think, are the values with which he made it. In our conversation, Todd told me, quote, "I would rather be remembered for the way I lived than the songs I sang." And that might sound a bit high-minded, but Todd meant it exactly the opposite way. He told me he lived by the troubadour's code: have guitar, we'll travel. His favorite thing to do, he said, was to roll into town, find a bar where people were drinking during the day, strike up a conversation, and see where things went. His only goal was to be invited along to wherever the people he met were going next. And then, around 7 o'clock at night, having not told his new friends who he was, he would ask if they wanted to go see a folk show. They would watch him jump up on stage and sing songs about people just like them who he had met in some other town, knowing they were likely to be the subjects of the song he sang in the next town. As a result of this approach, Todd's music was often centered on the stories of drunks, gamblers, small-time thieves, and generally desperate people. But he never made fun of them. The songs were invariably about doing your best against overwhelming odds and trying to have some laughs along the way. If there were villains in the songs, they were usually politicians or record executives. But even for them, Todd had a generous perspective. If he had a moral code, it was perhaps best expressed in the chorus of his song, "Happy to Be Here." Exhausted from another day of news headlines about political chaos and human depravity, he sings, "Well, I'm sure it's all true, and I'm tired of this too, but I can't pray for someone to fall. Let all them people do what people do. I'm just happy to be here at all." Towards the end of our conversation, I told Todd Snyder that was my favorite of his songs. Of all the many lines from your songs that I really keep close to me, the biggest one of all that I actually just want to thank you for in case I don't get another chance to talk to you is, "I'm just happy to be here at all."
Oh, thank you, man.
Because, I mean, from the second I heard that, I just thought, that is a way to live.
Yeah, I'm glad you picked that one. I feel that way, you know.
All of my neighbors are all up in arms about something they saw on TV. Seems some politician got busted for something that won't make any difference to me. Now I'm sure it's all true, and I'm tired of this too, but I can't pray for someone to fall. I let all them people do what people do. I'm just happy to be here at all.
All right, we'll let Todd Snyder take us out today. That'll do it for today's edition of the show. Don't forget, you can follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show, and you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radioheads. You can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. For Sam Dingman and Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us. Down from the smog of some Hollywood haze, I'm just... That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org, and you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.